Wow, what a great crowd. How many of y'all go to church here at Gooch Lane? Raise your hand. Let me see. And put your hands down. And how many of you are guests today? Wow, it's about half and half. That is really awesome. Listen, as I was sitting here this morning, it dawned on me that it's Saturday, that it's Saturday morning, and that it's summertime. And so I'm just trying to think of all the other possibilities of what y'all could be doing other than this. Like sleeping? Is that what you ordinarily would be doing at 10:05 on Saturday morning? Yes? Yeah, maybe. Mowing grass for mom and dad, right? Weeding the flower bed? Those are things you look forward to doing during the summer too, right? I'm just so impressed that you guys chose to come out here today and to be part of all this, because it is summertime and it is Saturday. And I know there are lots and lots of other choices that you could have made. So, wow, I'm real impressed with that. That tells me so much about all of you. And I'm really hoping that when we get done, you're going to look back on this morning and say that I'm glad I did this and that this was a good choice. For my little part in this, I basically want to do two things. I'm going to tell you a story, and it's going to take me a little while to get through the whole story. So get comfortable and just follow along. The handout has the story. You can actually follow the story there if you want to. I don't even care if you read ahead a little bit. And then when we get done with that, we're going to tie all of that to this theme of being holy in an unholy world and talk about some of the threats that you face to your holiness. And so I really do want to talk about that. So don't get too comfortable just listening to me talk, because in a little while I'm going to ask you to help me out and to share some of your thoughts as we go through our talk this morning. The story that I want to tell you centers around some events that took place in a little East Texas town called Haslam. Most people in Texas have never heard of Haslam, so I'm guessing that nobody in this crowd knows anything about this little town. It's really just a wide spot in the road. It's the kind of small town where people go to bed at night and they don't bother to check and make sure the doors are locked. And if they're going to pop in the convenience store and grab a Coke, they might leave the keys in the car. They might leave the motor running. It's just that kind of small town. But in late March of 1987, that small town spirit was shattered by a horrific murder. Carl Wrinkle owned a local grocery store. And on Sunday morning at 6 o'clock, his employees began to show up to open the store, and Carl wasn't there. And they immediately knew that something was wrong, because although he was a young man, not really a whole lot older than you. Did anyone here 18? 18, yeah. So I mean, he's like a couple of years older than Jake at this point in his life. Even though he was a young man, he was very responsible, and his employees knew something was wrong, and so they went looking for him. First, most obvious place to go was to his house. And when they pulled up in the driveway, they walked up in the carport, and they could see that the door into the house was cracked open. And they looked inside, and they could see his body lying there in a pool of blood where he had been brutally killed the night before. Now, even in a big city, that would have been news. But in a little town like Haslam, it was the news. It was the lead story in the local paper. That's a picture of the house right there. Everybody was talking about it. I visited Haslam a couple of years later, went across the river into Logansport, Louisiana, and I was talking to the librarian, and she said, oh, I remember when Carl was killed and how afraid we all were until they figured out who had done this and arrested them. And in fact, it was funny. She said, you know, after Carl was killed, I started locking my doors when I went to bed at night. But sadly, innocent people being brutally killed, especially in bigger cities, is all too common in our culture. And so even those of us who were alive in 1987, which would be none of you, some of those in the back there, and even those of us who lived in Texas, I was only about 150 miles from Haslam when all of this happened, we didn't hear anything about the story. I didn't learn of Carl Wrinkle's murder for more than a year after it happened. I was just starting out as a preacher. I was about 21 years old, and I was preaching in the other Huntsville. Y'all know there's another Huntsville, right? When I tell people I started out in Huntsville, they're like, oh, Alabama, which church? And I'm like, there is another Huntsville. You know where the other one is? Go ahead and say it. It's all right. Texas. We keep mentioning Texas today. Feel it. Shane is shaking his head. He knows I feel really, real good about that. That is my home state. I was starting out as a preacher in Huntsville, Texas, working with a little church there. Now, you need to know, do y'all know what makes Huntsville, Texas famous? It is not rockets and space. Sorry? Prisons, yes. That is the industry in Huntsville, Texas. When I lived there, there were 7 prison units that were in Walker County surrounding Huntsville, including this. This is a picture of the Ellis unit where they used to house death row inmates. And then right in downtown Huntsville, there's what they call the old walls unit. It's now called the Huntsville unit. And that's actually the door you go through to enter the death chamber where they carry out their executions. And that's typically what Huntsville is remembered for. It is where Texas executes men who've been condemned. Anyway, that's where I started my work as a preacher. And it was late one Thursday night. I got a phone call from a guy that I didn't know. And so you have to go through all the introductions of him explaining, this is who I am, and this is how I got your phone number. And so we go through all of that. And he said, Brother David, I need you to do something for me. There was this long pause that kind of said he was going to say something really important. He said, my son's just been convicted of capital murder in Shelby County. And they've sent him to Huntsville. He's out at the Ellis unit where he's awaiting his penalty, his execution. And he said, I live way up in Oklahoma. I need somebody close who can go see him and talk to him and help him get his life straightened out. And I found out that you were in Huntsville working as a preacher, and I was hoping that you would go. I did not want to go. I was not a whole lot older than those of you in this crowd who are juniors and seniors in high school, just out of high school. But I didn't know how to tell the man no. How do you refuse that request? And so I agreed to go out and to meet his son and to talk to him. And it was at that first meeting that I learned about the murder of Carl Rinkle for the first time and met the man who killed him. That man's name was Ricky Blackman. I will tell you that Ricky was not what I expected when I went to meet him for the first time. I kind of had some ideas about what kind of awful person could do such an awful thing. And I took those into the room there, the visiting room at the Ellis unit, the first time I went to meet with him. But the problem was, as he sat there that day and he told me his story for the first time, I just found out that he didn't fit any of the things that I brought into the room with me. He didn't fit any of my ideas about who could commit this crime. He didn't grow up in some big inner city in some dark recess where he was surrounded by crime and violence and gang and robbery and all that stuff. So that was just part of who he was growing up. He wasn't raised in an abusive home with parents who mistreated him or neglected him. He wasn't, at least as I was able to tell, crazy. In fact, the truth is, that is, he told me, I guess, the story of his life. It occurred to me that he hadn't grown up much different than I did. Probably not a lot different from you guys. He grew up in Mount Pleasant, Texas. Any of you heard of that? Dallas, Texas? Heard of that? Shake your head yes, please, so I know your way. Thank you. Okay, it's about 100 miles east, going toward Louisiana. Little place called Mount Pleasant, Texas. So he was raised in a small town. His mom and dad were Christians. They were members of the Southside Church on Jefferson Street. That's just across the highway from the Dairy Queen. I know where all the Dairy Queens are in East Texas. I make that my business. And they went to church every Sunday. In fact, his dad was sort of a preacher. I don't mean that he wasn't very good. I never heard him preach. What I mean is he had a full-time job that he worked all week. But on the weekends, he would go out to an even smaller little spot out from Mount Pleasant called Cooper's Chapel, Texas, and he would preach for a little church that met in that old building. This was Ricky's family's homestead. This is where his family for generations had lived, out in Cooper's Chapel. And guys, you're looking about all there is to Cooper's Chapel. There's a cemetery and that old building and a few houses in the distance, but that's about it. And in March of 1987, there was still a group of our brothers and sisters who met in that old church building for worship. If you're wondering, no air conditioning and no padded pews. You want to do 2 hours on that? And Ricky's dad would go and he would preach for these folks. And when he was a teenager, he would do what some of these young guys have done. He would get up and he would lead the singing for his dad. And so, as you can see, I got in that old building, kind of walked around a little bit. And I could get in my mind's eye a picture of that teenage boy sitting down there on the left. Can you see him? As his dad is wrapping up the sermon and he's going to say those words that will mark the cue among our brethren for the end of the service and for the song leader to do his job as together we stand and sing. Can you see him sitting down there waiting for dad to say those words? And I think at that moment when I was in that old church building that it struck me like never before that this is not the beginnings from which murderers come. And it made me think about the question that Michael Graysick, a reporter for the Associated Press, asked Ricky not long before he died. He asked him, how does the son of a preacher end up on death row? How do you start out in life with all these things right and end up so very wrong? I don't know that there is an easy answer to that question. But I do know Ricky's answer because I heard him give it again and again. If you ask Ricky, where did your life go wrong? He would say, I need to go back to high school when I was 15 years old. How many of you are 15? Raise your hand. Anyone here 15? Go ahead. It's okay to raise your hand. Okay? He was your age. He said, let me go back to the time I was 15 years old and starting high school. How many will begin high school this fall? When you go to school, you're going to start high school for the first time. One person in the entire room? Oh, you too. I'm sorry. I missed you up here. Well, that was when he was your age. You too? She is? Y'all are holding out. I'm getting this thing going on. We're going to have to work on the interaction thing because I'm not good at lecture. Anyway, he said, that's where my trouble started. 15 years old, starting high school. And he said, I started hanging with the wrong crowd. I want to be accepted by the right kids, the cool kids, the popular kids, and those kids at my school were into stuff that I knew I wasn't supposed to do. They were smoking and drinking, and I wanted to be accepted by them. And so in one of the letters he wrote to me, he said this. He said, before I knew it, I was in with the ways of the world. I'm talking about sex, dope, drinking, thinking my parents didn't know what they were talking about, telling me not to do this or that. And I didn't like someone telling me how to run my life. But as I look back on it now, my friends were running my life. But I was having fun the way they did, and it seemed I had control. But as I look back now, I see that I was wrong. So for him, that's where it started. And it continued that way. He continued running with the rough crowd into his adult life. He abused every kind of drug, though marijuana became his drug of choice. He was sexually immoral. He couldn't hold down a job. In fact, not long before he died, he sort of described what was the cycle of his life through his 20s. He said, I would go get a job, and I worked the job for 3 or 4 months, whatever the job, any job. And I would save everything I didn't have to have to live. And when I had a little stash put aside, I would quit the job and I would go party. And you understand by that, I don't mean birthday cake, candles, and ice cream, right? I mean, he would go party with his friends and use drugs and that kind of stuff. And he would live that way until all the money was gone. And then he would go and find another job. And so he was in this cycle where he was constantly in and out of debt. You know, he would party for a while and then all the money would run out and he'd be in trouble and he'd have to go find some other work. Well, in March of 1987, he was on the downside of the cycle. The money was gone. He didn't have any more money for drugs. And things were so bad that he was living in a tent out at the state park and when it was cold, sleeping in his car. But he was with a woman at that time who said she knew how they could get some quick money to buy more drugs. Because back in her hometown, there was a guy who owned a grocery store who always had money on him. Want to guess what her hometown was? You know how she knew Carl always had money? She used to shop at his grocery store. And he knew that she was down on her luck. And so she would come in, and he was kind of a brash young man, and he knew she needed help, so he liked to carry a big wad of 20s in his pocket, and he'd pull it out, and he'd pull off a few 20s, and he'd give it to this girl to help her buy groceries. And she repaid his kindness by helping to plot his murder. That's the story I learned the first time I went and visited with Ricky. He and I continued to study together for a couple of years while I was in Huntsville, and then I moved away to Chicago and later Orlando, and for over 8 or 9 years we continued to correspond back and forth. And then finally, it was right about this time of year, it was in July of 1999, that I got this letter from him. I guess from the very first time that he and I met each other, we knew that there would come a day when he would have to write this letter to me. The letter says, "Dear David and family, how are you? Fine, I hope and pray. Myself, I am nervous. I'm in touch with the Lord this day more so than I've ever been. My heart feels like I can't get it to pump enough blood, and my hand feels like it wants to start shaking, but I'm holding fast to the word of the Lord. Just today, I was informed of my execution date. I will go to be with the saints who are awaiting the day of judgment on August 4th, 1999. Well, brother, I'm sorry this letter is short, but I have much people to tell this to, so take care and remain strong as I'm trying to do. God bless you. Love, Ricky Dawn." On August 4th, 1999, Ricky was transferred from the Ellis unit to the Walls unit in downtown Huntsville, and then later that evening taken to the death chamber where he was executed for the murder of Carl Rinkle. 3 days before that, I went out and spent some time with him in that little visiting room at the Ellis unit. And we talked about a lot of stuff. Talked about his mom and the need to take care of her. Talked about the time we had spent together over the years, but more than anything, he talked to me about telling his story and how important it was that people would learn from the tragedy that was his life. He would be delighted to know that you were sitting here today hearing his story. He had a special passion for young people like you. I guess because in his mind, so many of his troubles started when he was young. And so he would be glad that you heard his story. But more important to him would be that you take away the lessons from his story. We've purposed today to talk about holiness. And my task in all of this is to talk to you a little bit about some of the things that threaten to rob you of your holiness. How do you do that? How do you set yourself apart and devote yourself to God in a culture where there is so much pressure to do otherwise? I want to talk to you about some of the things that are putting pressure on you, some of the threats to your holiness, because I think we see those things at work in Ricky's story. And I want to see if we can identify some of those and deal with them so that you'll avoid some of his same mistakes. Look on page 4, because I want to talk to you a little bit before we jump into that about turning points. I think that sometimes without even realizing it, we reach turning points in our life. We make decisions that wind up being pivotal decisions, important decisions, decisions that change everything that happens after that. In fact, sometimes I don't even think we realize we're making those choices. I think we reach turning points and we make a choice either to be holy in all our behavior or not to be. And we think we're not, that they're no big deal, only to discover later that, oh, I made a choice here that wow, that's more important than I thought it was. I think that sometimes even little decisions that we make day by day, the choice that you make on Monday morning about what you're going to put on and wear to school, the choice you make on Wednesday night about whether to stay home and study for the test or to go to Bible study and just stay up later. Even the little choices day by day wind up being pivotal, maybe even turning points, because they say something about the path that we're on. Matthew chapter 7, Jesus talked about two ways. Do you remember this? What are the two ways you can go in life? Matthew 7, 13 and 14. There's a broad way that you can take that leads to destruction and, I'm sorry? There's a narrow way that leads to, boy, y'all need to know this. What? Y'all have to say it loud because we're kind of spread out. Eternal life. Thank you very much. And so those are the choices. And sometimes just your little day-to-day choices are saying something about which path that you're choosing. And so I want you to think with me about that as we think about holiness today and some of the enemies of holiness. I want you to think about some of the choices that prove to be turning points in our life. Here's what I'd like you to do. I've given you a copy of the story because I want you to go back now and look at the story. And I want you to find the turning points. What do you think are the decisions that Ricky made along his way through life that proved to be turning point decisions? Decisions that changed everything that happened after that. I've given you at least 4 blanks, but there's lots of room there. You can go all over the place. Think of whatever you want to. You look back at the story. I'm going to give you a couple of minutes to do this. You find the turning points, and then I want you to tell me what you found, and we'll talk about them a little bit. Give you about 2 minutes to do that. Go ahead. Okay, while you're wrapping up, let me give you a little question and answer etiquette. We're in a big room and lots of folks in the room. So when you respond, I need you to have a nice big God-like voice. Speak up loudly because I want everyone to hear what you have to share. Can y'all do that for me? Also, the gap between my questions and your answer, let's shorten those down like less than 20 seconds so that we'll make good use of our time. Can y'all help me with that too? I want to know what you see in the story, a decision Ricky made that you think is a turning point for him. What'd you find? Yes, Jake.
He put the acceptance of his friends above the acceptance of God.
Jake sees the crowd as a problem, and actually you followed through. I didn't have to ask you why. You see the acceptance of the friend before acceptance of God. Why do you think that's so key? Okay.
He didn't care about, you know, whether it was wrong or not. He just wanted to be accepted.
Okay. So you think that's key. You think that's a big deal. Okay. Somebody else. What do you have? By the way, let me hold off a second. How many of you wrote something about the crowd? Oh, look at that. Very, very good. All right. Give me something different than the crowd. Yes. So you think the choice to start drinking was a turning point. Why do you think that's such a big deal? Okay, so Blair is saying that, so you're telling me the reason you think that's a turning point is because it just started a process. Have you ever heard of something called a gateway drug? Does anyone know what a gateway drug is? What is it? What is it?
It leads to other drugs that
are,
you know, more severe.
Yeah, I want y'all to remember that, because there's some people in our society that kind of frown on that notion that, oh, marijuana's not so bad, or alcohol's not so bad. But you are exactly right. It can be a gateway for a lot of people and a starting point, a turning point. Takes them down the wrong path. So with crowd, we got alcohol. What else? What else? You're right. Yes, Kendall.
Didn't listen to his parents.
He didn't listen to his parents, and you think that's key.
He didn't like the way that they told him to run his life.
Yeah. Why are y'all all up in my business? Yeah. Y'all ever said that? Don't raise your hand. You ever said that to mom and dad? I don't need you to tell me how to run my life. Y'all, like God told him to do that. Oh, I'll save that for later. Anyway, you think that's key. Why do you think that's such a key decision? Turning point, even.
Because parents have been down the road where the kids were, and some kids believe that they weren't at the spot where their parents were, so they think they can handle it on their own.
Okay, so we have not listening to his parents, we have the choice to start using alcohol, we have the crowd. What else did you write down? Give me something other than one of those three. Yes. He trusted in humanity. Is that what you said? More than God? Would that tie back to what Jake said about the crowd and about the friends, that his trust was in them, not in God? I'm going to say more about that in a minute. Hang on. Let me hang on to that thought. Somebody else over here. Yes. I'm sorry. I can't hear you. When he decided to commit the murder. You know, that's really interesting. Do y'all know that he didn't decide to commit the murder? The plan was not to kill him. You didn't know that part of the story. What was the plan? To take his money. See, that's the problem with sin. We think we're going to go this far, and what happens? What's the old saying? Sin takes us further than we plan to go, costs us more than we plan to pay. Yes, that is exactly right. But the choice, let me go back. Tell me your name, bud. Vincent. Go back to what Vincent said, because I think there's merit to what he's telling us here, that the plan to start the crime, guys, when we start out in sin, we don't always know where that's going to go. Okay? Give me some of your other answers. Who has something we haven't said yet? Yes, ma'am.
Kind of like going along with like his friends. I think
he was kind of weak-minded, because he was saying he didn't want people to run his life, but his friends were running his life, and he was pressured by that woman to make that decision. Or not, what to do, I guess. Yes, and let me tell you, he wanted a woman in his life, and he would do anything to keep her. You want to know a real turning point decision for a lot of people? Let me back up. I've got to have somebody in my life, so I'll do whatever it takes to keep them. And some people do some really dumb stuff. Sacrifice their purity, sacrifice their morality, and in Ricky's case, sacrifice his life to keep the girl. By the way, two guys are dead. Guess who's still alive? Guess who's going to get out? Anyone else have something to add to our list? Yes, Ethan.
What he decided to do after he got caught.
Wow, that's what a great... What did he decide to do after he got caught?
When he decided to change his life and turn
it around. Well, you know, Ethan's up here. He's got his mind channeled to the good. I like that. He did. He spent the last 11 years of his life choosing a different path. I think that's an excellent point. I'm glad that you said that. I'm going to give you my list. And all I'm going to give you is things that you've already talked about. I just want to explore them in a tad bit more detail before we wrap up today. Let's start with what Jake started with and talk a little bit about the crowd. How big was the crowd in Ricky's trouble? Was this a big deal? Yes or no? Yes. How was the crowd How did the crowd turn him away from the holiness God wanted him to have?
They affected his thinking.
How did they affect his thinking?
By making
sin
not
seem so bad, I guess. Making sin not seem so bad? Yes. What other thoughts do you have about that? How big of the, what was the role of the crowd in this? Am I not asking that question very well? Yes. Their example, he's following their example. What did he want from the crowd? Yes. He wanted acceptance. Let me read you from one of his letters. He said, I was baptized at 15 years old, and I helped my dad by leading singing every Sunday. As I got older, I started to have some friends that were not Christians, and the things that they did were fun. Some of the things they did I didn't want to do, but my friends would say, come on, it won't hurt you, or what's the matter, you scared? And after that, I thought it was okay. I started smoking cigarettes because my friends did. I started drinking because they did. And when I was in the ninth grade, I was introduced to smoking dope because my friend said, oh, you'll like it. And I did. Before I knew it, I was in with the ways of the world. And for Ricky, nothing was the same. Nothing was the same after that choice. I want you guys to get this. Here's a guy, 41 years old when he was executed, so he's well into his adult life, who's looking back, and he says, if you want to know what my turning point was, where everything in life changed for me, when I was 15 in high school. And the turning point decision was my friends. Bible say anything about this? What? I love that the heads went down to see if the passage was on the paper. It's not. Bible say anything about this? Where is it? That's okay. I don't care if you... It's not Ecclesiastes. 1 Corinthians 15. I didn't mean to embarrass you by asking you the passage. I want y'all to know this one. Does anyone know how that verse begins? Do not be deceived. Why does God say that? I'm sorry? Yeah, because He knows we're dumb. And we say things like, my friends won't affect me. God said they would. I don't know. Let's see. You are God. Who's right? Well, I'm going to go with God on that. Don't be deceived. Evil companions corrupt good morals. I love the passage. It's in Proverbs chapter 22 and verse 24. The wise man said, don't hang around with an angry man, or you will learn his ways. He'll be a stumbling block for you. Don't run around with that guy. The story in John 12 bothers me about the people who knew Jesus, had seen his miracles, and believed in him, but they wouldn't become his followers. It says because they loved the approval of men more than the approval of God. What's the lesson for you guys? What do y'all need to learn from this? Absolutely nothing. Wow, that was a tragedy. What do you need to learn?
Hang around good people.
Hang around good people. I want you to give very, very serious thought. Do not fall in with a crowd. Do not let yourself just sort of migrate toward a certain group of people because they're all in the ball team or all in the band. You need to choose your friends. You need to give some thought to it. You need to think about who I'm going to pull close, who I'm going to be texting, who's going to be on Facebook giving me advice and counsel and sharing their pictures. And when I am mad at my mother and I don't want to listen to her, who am I going to be talking to that's going to give me counsel and advice? You need to think about that. Choose your friends. I've been doing a research project. I've been talking to people in their 20s and 30s who grew up just like you did, doing sessions just like this. But something happened after they graduated high school and they spent some time out in the wilderness, off the reservation, away from Jesus. And then somewhere along the way came back to Him. I've been talking to people who have followed that path, trying to figure out why they went off the reservation. Guess what was a problem for every one of them? Every one of them said, my friends played a significant role in getting me off the path, in keeping me from being holy. So if you want to stay with Jesus and you want to be holy all of your life, really, really need to think about the crowd. Now, I almost wonder if you guys looked at my notes, because y'all almost brought up the things that I wanted to emphasize, and you almost did it in sequence, because Jake said crowd first, right? And Blair, what did you bring up? Drinking. So next thing I put up there is the drinking / drug issue. What role did this play in getting him into trouble? I'm sorry? It certainly impacted his ability to reason, which, by the way, is why alcohol and drugs are a problem for disciples. God tells us to live sensible lives in Titus chapter 2, which means clear thinking, governed by the Word of God, and you cannot do that when you are hyped up on alcohol or marijuana. That's why this stuff is sinful. What other role do you see it playing in Ricky's struggles?
It's a stepping stone.
How was it a stepping stone? Tell me what you mean by that.
It was kind of small stuff, but he didn't start off doing the hard dope or whatever. He started off with cigarettes and alcohol, so you can just get over the counter.
So you're seeing the progression problem getting him deeper into sin. Good. What other role do you see the drug thing playing in his life, in his troubles? I'm sorry? Could not have committed the crime had he not been on drugs. Why did he commit the crime? Do you remember that part of the story? He needed money for drugs. And that need was so great that he was willing to do almost anything to get it. Drugs had become his God. So what's the lesson for you? Sorry? Say that real loud.
Don't do drugs.
Don't do drugs. Just one word for starting down that path. That word is stupid. We just need to say that sometimes. I'm sorry if that was a bad word in your house growing up. But to even start down that path is just profoundly stupid. It's going to take your money. It's going to mess up your mind. It's going to rob you of your health. It's going to destroy relationships. It may take away your freedom. It may take your life. Okay? Just bad in every way. Don't even get started there. I do want to say a word to you guys about alcohol. I hear some really wacky things in the college crowd among our brethren today about alcohol. I hear people say things like that God doesn't care if we drink a little bit. I hear people say things like, even Jesus drank a little bit, and you know, that's okay. I want to warn you that most of the people who mouth off like that have never studied what the Bible says about alcohol. My question is, when I hear some young person say that is, have you read every passage in the Bible about alcohol? And if they say no, I'm not really interested in what they have to say. Because I think you need to read what the Bible says about it before you start saying things like Jesus would have had a few beers, because Jesus would not have had a few beers. We need to know what the Bible says about this and not just listen to what people say about it. I think when you look at the totality of biblical wisdom on this, God does not want us messing in any way at all with the stuff that is out there available to us. Just leave it alone. For an awful lot of folks, it is turning down a path that is just trouble. Yes, ma'am.
The alcohol content in the water they drink back then was a lot less than the one we have now.
That's why I say you got to read all that the Bible says about this. One of the problems is words, because we see the word wine, we think of that aisle in the grocery store where they have all the bottles. Biblically, the word wine is not limited to what's in that bottle. Biblically, it can be talking about juice that is still inside the grape. That's why I say, you really got to study what the Bible says about this before you start making profound statements like Jesus would have a few beers, which is just blasphemous. Anyway, I digress. You need to know what God said about it. And you need to talk to folks who have studied it. And so if you find yourself uncertain or wrestling with this issue, go talk to someone who has studied the issue and get them to help you study the issue and know what the Bible says before you start making decisions about joining the drinking crowd. I want to say a little bit about his rebellion. I'm about to run out of time, but I want to talk to you a little bit about his mom and dad. What role do you see, some of y'all mentioned the choice about his parents. What role do you see all of that playing in his trouble?
They could have turned him back around, but if he didn't listen, they'd join him on his wrong path.
Yes, and his parents did. Ricky had a very interesting relationship with mom and dad. Loved his parents. Hated that he got to see them so rarely. It was a 9-hour drive from where they lived in Oklahoma. And they could visit for 4 hours and then a 9-hour drive back. Did you do the math? How many hours is that? 9 down, 4 visiting, 9 back. How many? Yeah, that's a whole day. That's a whole day. They were older people. And they came as much as they could, but he hated not being able to see them, not being able to hug them. Always that piece of glass between him and his mom. And it frustrated him. But the problem was, as much as he loved his parents for a good period of his life, he didn't value them. His dad would say, "You're going to get into trouble." And he said, "I didn't think so." What did he say about that? "I didn't want anybody what? I didn't want anyone telling me how to live my life." When in reality, now he admits what was happening. His friends were telling him how to live his life. I want you to think about that. All of us are going to be guided and led by someone. It's just a question of who. This business of, "I don't want anyone telling me what to do." Everybody is taking their cue from someone. It's just a question of who. And so what does God say about this with reference to your mom and dad? What does it say before honor your father and mother? Children, Ephesians 6:1. I taught my kids to memorize this when they were 8 months old. That's probably an exaggeration, but not a lot. Children, obey your parents of the Lord, for this is right. And then what did you say? What does that mean? Honor your father and mother. What does honor mean? Respect? Anybody else want to take a shot at it? What does honor mean? Sorry? Make them proud? Anyone else? Do things that reflect well on them? Yes, sir. Hold them in high regard. Literally, the word honor means to value. That's literally the idea. To treat what they do and what they say as being very, very important. Let me tell you this. If you've never changed your mind about something because your parents of what something your parents said, you don't honor them. If you've never been determined to go one course, but then your dad said something to you about that and you decided to do something different, you don't honor your parents. Listen, if you've got a mom and dad who love Jesus and who are trying to teach you to love Jesus, you've got one of the greatest blessings you could ever have. Now, that doesn't mean we're going to get it right all the time. Parents don't do this thing perfectly, but that's okay because you're not doing the kid thing perfectly either. We all make mistakes along the way. But here's the thing about your mom and dad. They're just trying to get it right. Y'all know what they do at night after y'all go to bed? Do y'all realize this? I'm going to let you know a secret about your mom and dad. After y'all go to bed at night, they go back in their room and they shut the door. And you know what they do? They sit up late into the night. And they figure out ways how to make your life miserable tomorrow. Did y'all realize that? And if you believe that, you're probably wrong about a lot of stuff. Your parents do go back in their room. They do sit up late at night and talk about you and fret over you and pray about you and cry over you Because they just want to get it right. Somebody mentioned this a minute ago, that one of the benefits they have is that they're a little further up the road, and they've lived some things and seen some things. And so they're trying to help you along the way. By the way, why are parents doing that?
Because they care about you.
Because they care about you, but that's not the only reason. Why else are they doing that?
They want you to go to heaven.
Because they want you to go to heaven. But that's not the only reason. Though those are great reasons, why else are they doing that? What does Ephesians 6:4 say? Anybody know that one? Some of the dads? Sorry? Someone saying it? I told you, don't whisper godlike voice. What does Ephesians 6:4 say? Fathers, don't provoke your children to anger, but bring them up in the discipline and instruction of the Lord. Your parents are up in your business because God commands them to be up in your business. And one day they will stand before the judge and answer for whether or not they got up in your business. So when you're griping about that, your real fuss is really not with them. It's really with God. You need to make that a partnership, not a battle. Okay? Don't get to the point that Ricky got to. Still remember this part of the visit. First visit, tears started rolling down his cheek as he's telling about his mom and dad. And he gritted his teeth and he said to me, David, I wish I had listened to my dad. Don't make some terrible, dumb blunder and mess up your life because you chose not to listen to good parents who are trying to lead you in the right direction. For Ricky, that was a turning point. That changed everything. His parents had the answer that literally would have saved his life, but he didn't want anyone telling him how to run his life. Dumb choice. He would want to say, don't make that same mistake.